so far, the most promising thing I've tried is to cast the shot with metal studs. Chalk cracked like a staccato explosion as he tapped one of the diagrams on his wall. As you can see, the idea is that when the gunners insert the shot into the muzzle, they engage the rifling with the studs. Then the shot rides down, rotating as it goes, until it comes to rest against the propelling charge. When it's fired, the studs ride back up the grooves, which imparts a rapid spin to the shot, and off it sails to its target. He turned back from the wall to smile fiercely at Merlin, and Merlin smiled back. "The problem is this," Seamount continued, his smile fading slightly. "First, as we'd expected from the beginning, bronze is too soft, especially using the stud and groove system. The insides of the barrels simply shred after only a very few rounds. Secondly, I've already discovered that even with the stud and groove approach, bore pressures are rising dangerously."
"What do you mean, even with the stud and groove approach?"
"I expected bore pressure to go up drastically when I tried the lead coating system. After all, the shot was sealing the bore a lot more thoroughly, so it was inevitable the pressures would go up, the same way they went up in the rifles when we started using hollow-based bullets in them. But I'd rather hope that enough of the propelling gases would be able to escape around the shot, which is smaller in diameter than the bore, using the stud system. Which, by the way," he added parenthetically, "is one reason I'm irritated with myself for not realizing those same gases could ignite the fuse on their way past the shell. Anyway, I'd hope the windage between the shell body and the bore wall would let the gases escape and relieve the pressure."
"I can see that," Merlin acknowledged.
"Well, I suppose at least some of the gases are doing just that," Seamount told him. "Unfortunately, I don't think enough of them are. And there's another factor, too, one I hadn't really thought about initially. The shells we're developing for the existing smoothbores are the same size as a round shot they already fire, and because they're filled with gunpowder rather than solid iron, the shells are actually lighter than the shot the guns were originally proved for. But in a rifled gun, the shot doesn't have to be round. In fact, you don't want a spherical round. Since a more cylindrical shape lends itself more efficiently to rifling anyway, you end up with an elongated projectile. For an explosive shell, that will give me a larger internal cavity, which means I'll be able to pack in more explosive, and the fact that it's hollow will tend to hold the weight down, at least to some extent. For a solid shot, though, the overall weight of the shot goes up very sharply, and even with a gunpowder filling, a properly designed shell strong enough to stand the shock of firing without disintegrating is going to have thick enough cavity walls for it to weigh more than a round shot for the same gun. And that greater weight means the gun has to work harder to throw shells at the same velocities at which it throws round shot, and that drives up bore pressure too."
"All right," Merlin said, nodding to show he was following so far.
"We can cast iron guns and then cut the rifling grooves into them," Seamount said. "On the other hand, we've already got hundreds, thousands actually, of the new bronze guns. I'm sure we could find something else to do with all of that bronze, but it seems an awful pity after we've gone to all the trouble of casting them in the first place to simply throw them away, as artillery pieces, I mean. That's one problem. The other problem, frankly, is that cast iron is a lot more brittle than bronze. I'm not sure it's going to be up to the stresses that are going to be exerted once we start casting large-caliber rifled guns, not without going to truly enormous pieces, probably at least as big as or bigger than the old Great Doom Whale."
Which, Merlin reflected, had weighed almost 6 tons.
"But what would you use instead?" he asked aloud.
"At the moment, I'm thinking in terms of wrought iron," Seamount replied, not to Merlin's great surprise. "It'll be expensive, even more expensive than bronze, but Master Hausman says his ironmasters are equal to the task. I think he's probably right about that, but producing reliable wrought iron gun tubes is going to be expensive in terms of manufacturing time as well."
Merlin nodded again.
He wasn't surprised by the difficulties Seamount had encountered. Indeed, if he was surprised at all, it was by how quickly the Carisian had experienced them. Which was foolish of him, he supposed. If Sir Alfred Hendrick had demonstrated anything, it was that his mind was every bit as quick and focused as Prince Narmon's, if in very different directions. The problem, as Seamount had just pointed out, was that cast iron was brittle. Safeholdian foundry techniques were remarkably advanced for a culture where steam power had been prohibited, yet they still weren't up to mass production of steel by a considerable distance. The technology itself lay within their grasp, but there were still obstacles to be overcome. The fact that Safeholdian foundries had been using water wheels for centuries helped, but it was only in the last few decades that men like Edward Houseman and his mechanics had begun applying power to the process more generally. Initially, the water wheel's only true function had been to power blowers to raise the temperature in Safeholdian blast furnaces and fineries. The processes for turning blast furnace iron into wrought iron and steel had been no further advanced than perhaps 1700 Europe.